Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today. Welcome to filmandtvreview.com. Catch the latest film, TV, and streamed show reviews every week. The views and opinions expressed by the authors and those providing comments are theirs alone. They do not reflect the views, opinions or position of filmandtvreview.com or their respective parent companies or affiliates. Filmandtvreview.com makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, suitability, or validity of any information in this program and is for entertainment purposes only. Episodes may contain adult humor and language. For full terms and conditions, see filmandtvreview.com.
Hello there, and welcome to our monthly review of film and TV releases. And over the last, this summer, some big releases, obviously, this year, and some hits and maybe bombs at the box office. But we'll be covering The Odyssey, Toy Story 5, Supergirl, Evil Dead Burn, He-Man, Master of the Universe, Disclosure Day. Anyway, we'll kick off with probably the biggest release, which has come out most recently, actually, which is Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, his adaptation of a book, a recent book that was doing its own adaptation of the classic Homer tale, came out, just I think last week, actually. So I think across the world. So for those who saw it, I think let's start with Richard. Of course, Christopher Nolan is one of those directors where people flock to see based on the name, one of the few directors left. What was your impression of The Odyssey?
Obviously it was a big moment because now every Christopher Nolan movie is like an important moment for every single movie goer in the world, apparently. So there was expectation, and I'm not sure, but it's worth talking about what the plot is, because I'm guessing most of the people know about the story of the Odyssey and who is in French, Ulysse, Odysseus, and what is done, etc., like Troy and Achille, etc. But so let's just go straight away to my expectations, and did it meet my expectations? The movie marketing plan was to focus mostly on the fact that this movie was, for the first time in history, directed in an IMAX format, 70 millimeters exactly. I'm guessing because everybody knew the plot, so obviously they were talking about the technical part of the movie, most of it. I've seen it in an IMAX part, but not in an IMAX 70 millimeters, because, by the way, not many movie theaters in Europe has that kind of technology. In France, there's only one movie theater in Montpellier, in the south of France, and that's it, that can do IMAX 70 millimeters. There's one in Belgium, not far from Paris. And I think there's the BFI in London, and that's the only one in London, if I'm not mistaken.
I think, there's one in Leicester Square also, but when looking at
Do IMAX 70 millimeters? That's the question.
Definitely the Waterloo one is probably the one, but all bookings for IMAX obviously booked every weekend. So, as I say, limited venues for that format, but I know, yes, it was shot. Yeah, so.
It was. It wasn't that far, Richard. You should have gone to Belgium or
To
Montpellier.
Montpellier? To Montpellier is like
Montpellier, yeah.
4 or 5 hours train, man.
Sorry. Your cinephile card has been revoked.
But just a side note, actually Montpellier travel office noticed actually that there was an increase of 200% of hotel bookings in the last 15 days. And they say it must be because of this, because Montpellier is not a big city for
You
tourism.
see?
For this the so yeah, I'm guessing that if you want to watch this movie based on the marketing part, you will actually focus on the spectacle and the big entertaining scenes more than the plot. Strangely, for me, actually, the strength of this movie, let's say, is not the great supposedly entertaining, sorry, a part of this movie. Is actually the acting and more of the little scenes, dialogues between two main characters, namely Charlize Theron and Matt Damon on one side, and Anne Hathaway and Tom on another side. I thought these scenes actually were actually the strength of the movie, surprisingly for me. I thought I was more involved in the movie when they were focusing more on the drama happening in these two parts of the world at that point of the story, and those points of the story. When supposedly there was supposed to be like grand spectacle with the Cyclops and or the giant armored
Knights,
knights,
whatever they were.
cannibal knights, apparently they were cannibals. I didn't realize that. Apparently the cannibals in
Oh.
the original story. All these things, either I got bored watching these things, kind of repetitive actually, these challenges for Odysseus, and but also made me laugh at some point because I was thinking, after an hour, every time we were seeing Matt Damon and his crew, they were going on an island, fighting something, losing, and then running away like morons on the beach, going back to their boats. And I was thinking, these guys are not heroes; they are just losers. That was my interpretation after an hour. But I'm joking, but not really joking. Anyway, no. As I said, yeah, I truly believe actually that the drama was more interesting. The fact actually that he was obviously unreachable for decades, that his wife had to literally survive by herself, kind of, with all the suitors. I think the acting, as I said, was extremely well done from everyone, even the small parts, let's say. Robert Pattinson, for example, I think was very good at what he has to do. I think his name is Samantha Morton, who plays Cersei, who played in Minority Report as well. I think she's, and Walking Dead as well, by the way, also in the last season. I think she's extremely good. And Anne Hathaway is always great. I think the acting overall is really good. But yeah, I wasn't very impressed by the great spectacle and the entertainment part of it.
Hey, Alfonso, how did you find Christopher Nolan's Odyssey?
Well, I kind of agree with Richard. I also thought that the actors were pretty, I mean, great. I like the story of the Odyssey itself. I think it has been first told like orally for centuries, and so it has had time to be refined over the centuries. And Nolan does his own interpretation of it, which has also some commentary on, let's say, recent events, I would say. Within the story. And I also like that kind of commentary through the story of the Odyssey. And what Richard was saying about how this seemed to be like who's gonna be left after each island. And sometimes the men of Odysseus were like, why don't we wait just a day to go into the next island, please? Because we are we're gonna take it anymore. Men, stay on the shore, because you're kind of like the worst thing that ever happened to us. We keep being murdered by so
Exactly.
many things.
And eaten.
And it's not be maybe it's not because of you or how you pick your islands, but I mean, what's happening here? So yeah, that part of, I mean, it was adventures and stuff, so it was I don't know, I liked it more than your average blockbuster. And at the same time, I missed a little bit the, because I like the practical effects, but I would say that kind of realism in like colors or clothing or style of housing or whatever, that's not just not my vibe. I prefer a little bit more Hollywoody kind of thing. But that's just me, I would say. I think it's entertaining, and I think, I don't know if some people have told me that maybe it tries to do too much in like being bigger, socially speaking, or whatever of in themes than what it is, the kind of story that this is like an adventure and family reunification and stuff. But I don't know. I think it works. Basically, it works to me, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely a lot of themes going underneath there, I found. But Andrew, you think this made it a bit more than the average blockbuster, maybe thematically, or I mean, quality cinematography is great, obviously, as well. Did you find this a bit more substantial, or on what level did you enjoy it, if you
Yeah,
did enjoy it?
I guess just to continue, I guess maybe from what others were saying, and I guess Alfonso was mentioning this with recent events and the idea of, I guess the theme throughout the film is guilt, and not just guilt about the people lost on the title Odyssey itself, but also from before the things that happened without going to many spoilers about that, about the conduct of war and that and how Odysseus is dwelling on that. And I don't know if that's something that's been seen in other versions of this story. I mean, there's other adaptations. There was like a adaptation done, I guess it was a miniseries done in the late 90s of Armin Desante, and then in the 1950s a version of Kirk Douglas. I think other versions, but yeah, this one of the themes is guilt, and in particular, one of the sub themes is guilt over conduct in war. So it's not just, hey, war heroes, that kind of thing, but that there's maybe people who were killed in the Trojan War weren't just combatants. And, that's a big thing that kind of weighs on Odysseus and him thinking about that, and how it allows him to interact with people that he knows, and whether what he's seeing is really what he's seeing at certain points. And then you also have the subplot of Telemachus, Tom Holland's character, and that's a big thing, is his story and him trying to find his father. This is Odysseus' son, trying to find his father and going to then visit the king of Sparta. And Helen and that whole bit, and then the suitors who are trying to back home in Ithaca, they presume that Odysseus is not alive anymore. So as you know the story, there's all these suitors who are trying to woo his wife. They think the widow Penelope, played by Anne Hathaway. She has all these suitors, and one particular played by Robert Pattinson, who kind of becomes, I'd say, the villain of the story. One of the main villains of the story, I guess. So there's definitely a lot going on there, and it becomes an adaptation expansion, not just because of things that you already know in the story or that are part of the story, but also things that may be part of other stories, like about Agamemnon and what awaits him when he returns home. This is the leader of Mycenae, and that whole story, which isn't part of the Odyssey, but it gets mentioned here, or not part of the original story by Homer, but and some other things, like there's like a character who has a name, Sinon.
Sinon, yeah.
Yeah, then that name comes from a different story altogether. So there's all kinds of things going on here, not just the actual story of the Odyssey. So it's definitely an adaptation expansion. Just saying a lot because there's a lot going on in the story itself. But yeah, no, definitely a lot of good themes that kind of tied into more modern events, as has been said before, as well as the acting and then the look of the film and the imagery. There's also a lot of the Nolan technique of things being told in not necessarily chronological order, sort of like flashback here and a flashback there. And yeah, I think people are kind of used to it from that director. So that's
my probably did work. Actually did work well, his kind of like his style and usually reliance on flashback and flash forward. But I think it did actually work well in this actual story. And so it was a good marriage between them. So, but yeah, you didn't find it a bit too distracting because it was a very much a very Hollywood cast. But then maybe you need that just to sell this film. But that's the only thing. Maybe it was a bit, you know, familiar faces that we kind of know, but they're good actors. I mean they are actually good at what they do, so maybe can't gripe too much. But yeah, generally quite. And I'm glad I actually went to see it on the cinema. I did see a super screen, if not IMAX, and it is beautiful to look at actually. So yeah, it's a good experience, I think. And
to be fair, it's true for most of movies by Christopher Nolan in the last 10 or 15 years. I wonder if, again, this IMAX 70 millimeters was really worth it. That would be a question mark for me, but I wonder. But
yeah, I'm glad I saw it in the format I did. I didn't think I was missing. These super screens are quite big anyway,
yeah,
but
yeah, the IMAX, definitely a big cinema experience every time. But this specific format, I'm not an expert in cinema to see the difference, let's say, between the two, I'm guessing.
I saw it in a screen that had like a super surround with loudspeaker in the ceiling and everything, and I became a little bit tired of the sound of like so many battle scenes and like the polyphemus and everything went. So it was a little bit tiring sound wise. And the thing about IMAX is that it's also a format that, funnily enough, it's a little bit square. It's very big, but it's a little bit square. I don't know. It has its good things in it, but I don't really enjoy that much, that kind of square kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it is just out there, so we'll see how much money it makes.
It makes a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think, and some good performers. I can't fault it too much, really, honestly. And it's enjoyable. And it is a classic story if you're not familiar with it. But it's well told and well shot. And it's a lot of fun as well. Right. Next. An earlier title by another movie maestro, Steven Spielberg. His return to, let's say, the alien encounter kind of like territory, which he's obviously visited previously in Close Encounters and I guess even E.T. It's Emily Blunt, big stars in a kind of like a, well, as the name suggests, a disclosure of the big secret of maybe we are not alone. I guess a big expectation of this. And who saw this? Richard, did you see Disclosure Day?
I said unfortunately.
What were you expecting first, and what was delivered that maybe?
So the thing is that it's interesting, by the way, that we choose to talk about Steven Spielberg movie just after Christopher Nolan, because some people actually call Christopher Nolan like the Spielberg of his generation. Disclosure Day might be actually right now the biggest disappointment for me of the year. And I'm not kidding, I mean, this TV shows, movie, whatever, this is the biggest disappointment, because obviously I tried my best back in the day to watch no trailers. Well, I'm not dumb, so I knew what it was about, but I didn't watch any trailer, etc., because I really want to go fresh in the movie theater and have the experience. Spielberg obviously has a long history of movies and TV shows in regards to aliens and aliens first encounters. It had a good cast. I said, okay, why not? It's going to be cool, etc. It was such a disappointment. And here's, should I say what's about? But I'm guessing everyone knows what it's about. It's obviously about the first encounter with alien intelligence on Earth, and the fact that Disclosure Day, it's like a big day, because it will be the day where everything that has been hidden, let's say, apparently by especially the US government in the last 50 or 60 years, will be really revealed to the world. Everything since the Roswell incident in 1947 until today. Okay. Disappointment, why? Because it could be so much smarter than it is, and it's not smart. It's extremely not stupid, but naive. I mean, the plot is, I know he's not, I'm not sure it's Steven Spielberg who wrote the plot. I think that there is someone else wrote the plot, but I don't care. He is the one actually who directed it, and he is actually, he should have a look at it before actually directing this thing. The story is from him. I said the plot is naive. What I'm saying about is because in the 1970s, 1980s, when you had Close Encounter of the Third Kind, E.T., all that kind of stuff, you had a different kind of cinema, in my opinion, but Spielberg was the master of it. And it was very well done. And it was about aliens, etc. But it was a different world we were living in. Now he tries to do a movie in the 2000, in 2025, 26 about alien encounters with, let's say, with technologies and things of the 21st century that he almost forgot. Because what I'm trying to say is how the information of alien existence on Earth will be divulged, will be given by anyone right now. It's totally different from what we see in this movie. I'm not very clear. In this movie, Emily Blunt is kind of working on the TV. Sorry, I'm going full spoiler straight away. The last half an hour of this movie is this disclosure. And for some reason, she thinks that the only way to disclose this magical information is to go live on kind of CNN and talks to the whole world about some alien footage from the 1940s, 1950s. And apparently, this will be the only thing that will convince everyone. That's one thing out, and there's not so many other plot holes, but this is the greatest plot holes in movie history. How is it possible that Spielberg believes that a disclosure date, something that will be an historical moment in for humanity, will be so simple? In the age of social media, in the age of fake news, well, so-called fake news, in the age of nobody believes in what they see on TV, in the age of AI, etc., the whole last half an hour, and I'm not even talking about the hour and a half before, but the last half an hour is kind of Spielberg imaginary world where he lives in since E.T., since Close Encounter of the Third Kind. But it's not 2026, the real 2026. So how can you believe what he's saying? I don't understand. X-Files did it 1,000 times better, and it was the 90s and the 2000s, 20 years, 30 years ago. It was so realistic the way actually that they would disclose this information and how they will fight from the, how the government will fight in every way they can actually to prevent this information to be public, etc. X-Files, with all the criticisms that you have about CGI, etc., of the back in the 90s, the plot of X-Files episodes, especially about aliens, is 10 times better than this plot. Sorry, I'm very confused about my post, because I'm really upset when I see that it's Steven Spielberg, like the genius Steven Spielberg, who provides such a bullshit movie. I'm sorry, that's my
No, that's just
sorry, that's my rant. But
tell us what you
I'm
think.
sorry, it was very confusing. I agree, but it was on my chest for a month. So yeah.
I'm glad that chest burst out of you too. Alfonso or Andrew, did you get to seek a disclosure?
Mean, it's a
And did you share? Did you as disappointed as Richard or surprised?
I'm disappointed. It's definitely a lot to take in because the first time I saw it was at this advanced screening, and it's definitely a lot to take in because it's not just, this happens and that's that, and then I had to kind of watch it a second time a few weeks later to kind of, when I had some more time to process what I had seen. There's definitely a lot going on, so it's not just, oh, this person and evil corporation and conspiracy. I mean, yeah, there is that, but there's also some other things going on. And I think because also the film shifts focus, because you have this one protagonist played by Josh O'Connor, and the film focuses on him and his girlfriend for a bit, and then the film shifts focus to Emily Blunt's character as the meteorologist and her boyfriend, who's played by Wyatt Russell. So it seems to kind of focus from one person to another, and then it ties the stories together, and then everything kind of connects. So there's definitely a lot going on, and it's almost like something that I feel almost could have been done better as a series. So it's interesting you mentioned series. But so it's definitely a lot there. The film is like maybe 2.25 hours long if you take the, subtract the closing credits. And there's a lot of themes there about conspiracy, government cover-ups. There's also a conflict going on in the background, and people seem like the world's on edge, like World War III could break out, North Korea. I wish some more had been done with that. I wonder if this had, I don't know about the whole behind the scenes. I wonder if this is something that's maybe started out as a series and then changed into a movie, because I kind of got that feeling. I like what's there, just to be clear. So I don't know about disappointed, but at the same time, I kind of wish, without going to spoilers, the movie seems to just end where it ends. And I'm kind of like, okay, is there more that's going to happen? And I kind of feel like this is something that is like the pilot for a series rather than a complete movie. So something good as a good start, but I wish they had done more with it in terms of giving it a completeness. I mean, the actors that are there do a good job, and I wish they had also done more with Eve Hewson's character. That's the girlfriend of Josh O'Connor's character. His character is like a whistleblower for this evil corporation in the movie, yes. And her character, Eve Hewson's character, is former novitiate, I guess, for the Catholic Church. She was in training to be a nun, but didn't follow through, didn't take her vows. So she's not a nun. Without going into that whole story, so with her character, you kind of get a sense of, is religion going to play a role, and that does get touched on. So I wonder if maybe more could have been done with that. Like, I would be more curious to see that whole story, and what it's like, and how does religion play a part in this? Not necessarily Catholicism, but just the idea of faith and a greater purpose and the greater whatever to what's going on. So yeah, there's definitely the sense I get as I say this again is that this feels like something that's a pilot for a series, but what, is there more to it? So yeah, seeing it as just a movie, beginning, middle, and end, yeah, I mean, I like what I've seen so far, but I just feel it's just not really complete, and I wish there could have been more to give it a sense of completeness, being that this is a movie and not a series, so.
François, did you see Disclosure?
Yeah, it's basically a chase film, but I think the chasers were not good in at their job,
Oh,
and
they were terrible.
neither were the people who were being chased as to think about what they actually wanted to do, what they were what with what they had. Like, none of them were good or did some things logically throughout the movie. So, and even the people who were helping the people who were chased, being chased, those people, if you think about what they were doing, and it doesn't make any sense.
Thank
So it doesn't make any sense. The people who were chasing the protagonist, bad at their job. The people who the protagonist, bad at being escaping. And the other
you.
ones that were helping the protagonist, bad at whatever they were trying to do because it didn't make any
Yeah,
sense.
thank you.
I mean, of the origin of what they were doing, like how can you anyway? So it I'm sorry, but it feels like Steven Spielberg entering his M. Night Shyamalan, the trees are coming after us era of movies that just don't work, but
Yeah.
are from their heart. To me, that starts with Shyamalan and the Lady in the Water. To other people, it's later. But anyway, movies that come from I want to say something, and but it doesn't really gel. Like, I don't, Spielberg wants to say something about humanity and aliens, and Well, funnily enough, I prefer M. Night Shyamalan's Signs in this regard, which I think it's more accomplished. Or maybe I was going through this kind of religious crisis or something at the
No,
time, and it
Signs
spoke
is
to
a great
me.
movie. Signs is a great movie.
Well, it's, yeah, because for example, if you compare, for example, in Signs, there is a protagonist who is having a religious crisis, a crisis of belief. And if you compare it with a side character here who live with the nuns, and that's the religious part of this film, it doesn't have the same weight when you put it in the protagonist and you put something that like is about that. That is, you put it in a side character to talk about the thing. I feel like in this film, sometimes people are talking about the themes of the movie, like in some Shyamalan films where people are also talking about the themes of the movie. But the movie itself tries to get everything together, but it really didn't work for me either. Just because as a chase film that ends in a disclosure or whatever, it just I mean, I appreciate the Spielberg of it all, how he moves the camera, how I don't know, but at the same time, I was all the time a little bit like, ah, no, not working, not working. I'm not buying this thing. Anyway.
Oh dear. Right. Wow. Okay. Maybe better luck next time. It's
I
right.
should give up.
Yeah.
Should retire. Should retire.
Never count him out. Well, who knows? Who knows? But anyway, yeah, it's a shame. But yeah, as you say, maybe a bit of a disappointment considering his pedigree. But next, another outing for a long-running franchise, Toy Story 5, this one. Buzz, Woody, and Jesse and the rest of the gang meet up once again and come face to face with, I guess, technology, I suppose, the tablet era and device personified by Lilypad with her own disruptive ideas of what's best for, I guess, Bonnie. Again, the cast return, so Tom Hanks and Tim Allen. I've never kind of like watched. Been a big, huge follower of this, but it's got its following from, I guess, quite a generation. So, is there life in the old franchise yet? Or, who saw Toy Story 5? No.
I did.
Indeed.
And I really liked it, to my surprise, because I'm not a fan of the series. Not one of those people that really loves Toy Story 3 or whatever. No, but I did this one. I thought it was very clever. It was very entertaining. Lots of characters that the whole saga has accumulated, plus a few more in this installment. And I thought it had a great script. It could work with so many characters and put them all to use. And the themes of the film, or what is playing, what is the advantages and disadvantages of technologies such as an iPad, or other themes such as like being part of a group or being left out or even sort of bullied for not being like part of the things and not doing the same things as other people and growing up and trying to fit in. Oh no, there were many, many things, but at the same time, it was fun. It played with so many characters, and which is very difficult. And all of them were integrated into the story, and I had a great time.
Yeah, that's some good reviews from that, actually, from this installment. Anyone else? Andrew, did you see this?
Yeah,
Yes.
I saw it. Yeah, no, it's yeah, I mean, when it was kind of announced, and I think this is sort of the sense that the series could have ended with the third film and then just keep going, but yeah, each installment that they've done, Toy Story 4 was decent, and this one I would say I like more than that one. I would say the strength of this one, and because you talk about yeah, Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, they're pretty much the focus of these films and the franchise and marketing, but in this one, Yeah, Tim Allen, he does quite a bit work both as the main Buzz Lightyear, and then you have some new Buzz Lightyear models who appear in the film and then become part of the plot. Woody, who at the end of the fourth film, he kind of joins a different group of toys, and yeah, he returns to his former friends, or to his friends, I should say, in this film, but he doesn't really do as much here. So really the main character as far as toys are concerned is Jessie, the one played or voiced by Joan Cusack. And you go into her backstory, which you knew a little bit from earlier films or early parts of the franchise. And I guess her former kid, former owner was named Emily. So you go into her backstory, and that becomes a thing. So it ties into what's going on here. At the same time, you have these new characters who are basically the different technologies. There's like an iPad XP called Lilypad, or Lily for short, is voiced by Greta Lee, and other new technologies. And I think the strength of this film comes from adapting these new technologies into the story, and the idea of kids growing up too quickly and not really playing with the toys so much. And is that really a good thing? Losing the creativity, growing up too quickly, and focusing on these new technologies and interacting with kids through these technologies. And that brings up the issue of is that really the healthiest thing? And cyberbullying, and that becomes a big thing in the film. So yeah, it's definitely got a lot going on for just what we think of as a kids film. But I mean, it's Pixar, and the strength of Pixar's films is to go beyond just entertainment, or certainly children's entertainment. That's something that adults can appreciate as well. So yeah, and the opportunity to focus on Jessie and that character instead of just Buzz and Woody all the time. Yeah, I mean, they're good characters, but yeah, there's other characters as well. And to incorporate the new characters, and also the human characters, and what's going on with them. And we meet some new human characters, and how do they contribute to the plot. So yeah, no, it's definitely yeah, I mean, I know people were skeptical. We really need another Toy Story film. So yeah, it definitely adds some more things to, well, not just a franchise, but some new messages about spending too much time online, and is that really a healthy thing for children? So yeah.
Yeah, I think it's done really well. Also, it was word of mouth. It's got around with this one. So, yeah, much life in the old franchise yet. Next, kickstarting its own franchise, the DC entry of Supergirl. This time, stepping into the boots is Millie Alcock, and directed by, now I was almost going to say James Gunn, but it's actually by another director of I, Tonya, and I think Cruella, and I think that's Gillespie, I think Chris Gillespie or something like that. So again, this follows her cousin of Clark Kent or Superman, and of course big DC character, which is making its own reboot kind of like a year or 2 years ago. Kicks off in her own spacefaring adventure where she's celebrating or commiserating her 23rd birthday, or and gets mixed up in a kind of a kidnap plot to rescue her dog from pirates, and gets involved in a kind of a quest with a another young girl out for revenge. And I think based on a comic book run, I think a popular one. I think again, is curious what to expect from this incarnation of Supergirl, and is it a good foundation to add to the DC universe? I saw this. I do have my thoughts on this, but who else saw Supergirl? Richard, you're like a man who went to go first in line to see
Yeah, so
Supergirl.
as a matter of fact, if we forget that It's called Supergirl. That movie is not that bad. But that's a problem. So in what I'm trying to say is made me think of Star Wars Last Jedi. Star Wars Last Jedi was a very good movie. Unfortunately, it's called Star Wars. That's a problem. It's actually that you have sometimes good movies, and their problem is that they are connected. The problem, so it's not like actually that we forced them to do this movie. I mean, they knew what they were signing up for. But the problem is that yeah, it is supposed to be connected to a character, a universe already established. And that's the problem of Supergirl, in my opinion. Actually, but if it wasn't a Kryptonian and everything that we know, if you like comics and if you like the DC studios, etc., as a movie itself, it's okay actually. It's kind of entertaining. It's a story of a girl, kind of an alien girl who looks like a human, who has powers, who got her dog kidnapped or whatever. Oh no, sorry, injured, and she has to find a cure for this dog, etc. And she goes on that quest with a child who becomes like a protege, and the child sees this older girl as a mentor or whatever. There's something there. There's something interesting here, and actually there are some scenes that I quite enjoyed, etc. Problem is that every time there is something that is interesting, I mean, like a blockbuster scene with big fights, etc., or good line of dialogue, etc. Every time you have a voice in your head saying, "Remember, it's Supergirl," and cousin of Superman and from Krypton, etc. You say, "I am man." Doesn't make any sense then. Every time this voice in my head comes back, and that's the problem. And that's the same thing with Star Wars, some of the sequels, I think. You have people who have talent. I'm pretty sure that this director that I never heard of has talent. I'm pretty sure that Mindy Alcock, if she does something else, she's gonna do well. But unfortunately, it's a Supergirl movie, and you have to follow certain rules, let's say, and these rules, in my opinion, are either not followed or they just don't care, and it makes no sense. I mean, you have she should be as powerful as Superman in regards to powers, but sometimes for some reason she doesn't want to use her powers because why? So, okay, why not? You know? Yeah, I don't know. That's the first problem. The second problem is yes, it's not directed by James Gunn, but for me, the influence of James Gunn on this franchise is crazy. Because I know it's something that you have read online and it's true. Even if you don't read it online, the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you will think, okay, it looks a lot like Guardians of the Galaxy vibe, to be honest. So it's kind of a mix between Guardians of the Galaxy and John Wick, I guess, because of the dog stuff. But you know, I mean, again, all this doesn't mean it's a bad movie. Again, if you put aside all this crazy thing that Warner Bros. Is doing with trying to reboot all this bullshit, etc., DC stuff, and you just try to turn your brain off. I know I don't like saying that, but and just try to enjoy a movie for 2 hours, that's all right. You're gonna forget about it, but at least for 2 hours, you're gonna have a good ride, I guess.
It's definitely a very I was kind of got a it's got a bit of an identity problem for sure, because as soon as you, like you said, the first 5 minutes, it's a soundtrack, it's a it's a drop of a popular classic soundtrack, and then it's the titles come up and it's like, well, this is a Marvel James Gunn production. This is, and but then you have to look who directed it, and then it's someone else with a totally different a talented director in his own right. It seems almost like scared to be its own DC kind of vibe, as it were. And it's and I think Millie Alcock is actually, she's not too bad in it. She's actually, I think she is a good actress for what she's given. She does a good job, but it is a terrible script, or it's very mangled. And maybe it's how it's cut. It's like a first draft script, but then it hasn't been polished and restructured into a really cohesive and logical step by step how things should follow, especially for character growth, which is supposed to be what the aim of this, I think, for her to find her place and
And for some reason, again, and I said that I know I'm a broken record, and for some reason, again, you have a super powerful being. And I'm guessing that when you have the studio executive in the room saying, "We have a plot, but she's too good, she's too powerful, so we try to modify the plot." So actually, but 90% of the movie, she will be without powers because we need to humanize characters from Krypton. Why? Why do you need to do this? Why do you need to have Supergirl or Superman every time looking like human beings. Your chapter, you call it, you call this chapter Gods and Monsters. They are Kryptonians on Earth are gods in the DC universe. Let them be gods. I don't get it. I don't get it.
Anyone, I think Andrew, did you see this or did you get the
Yeah.
chance to just your thoughts?
Because I guess it's interesting you mentioned, I guess it was supposed to be adapted from the Woman of Tomorrow storyline. And that was, I think, one of the two complaints that I've seen about this is that it's not really an adaptation. I mean, it's supposed to be, but apparently those who've read it, who've read the comic that's supposed to be based off, are like, well, it's not really adapted from it, even though it was technically supposed to be. And the other complaint I've seen, I didn't really think about this, is that the for the without spoiling too much the climax of the film, they played a really slowed down version of the Jimmy Eat World's In the Middle, and that song choice was kind of an unusual choice, all to say, and I think people were kind of not happy with that as a song choice for whatever reason. And also, the person who directed this, Craig Gillespie, he also directed Lars and the Real Girl, which is about 20 years old. It had Ryan Gosling in it and was a critically acclaimed film when it came out. So I guess he's seen as a capable director. I think the main issue for me of the film is, and it goes back to what's been said so far, is I guess for me is that this is one of the first films of the DCU, or they call it the DCU, not. It's supposed to be MCU, this is the DCU, and you kind of get people excited about this new cinematic universe. And again, to have Kara Zor-El or Supergirl not to have her powers, or to basically be faced with as a main threat space pirates or space traffickers or whatever. Yeah, maybe if you do several films in, or as an episode of a TV show where it's like you have all these other episodes, the character facing threats, and here you want him to face like a pretty serious threat. You want people to be excited not just about the character, about the movie, but about the DCU in general. And instead, it's like, oh, she's facing some space pirates or space traffickers or whatever, and where's the big threat? I mean, it's not really a good really introduction to this new cinematic universe, or semi-introduction. You already had the Superman movie last year and some series, but this is really, people are still getting introduced to this new cinematic universe, and this is not really the way to go about it. You want the threats to be, you want the stakes to be a little bit higher than what it is. I mean, there's some interesting concepts there in terms of the nature of the villains, what they're up to, but I think, again, you could have had the stakes higher if this is what you want people to be enthused about, getting to this whole world building that you're doing. I did like some of the scenes, the flashbacks of them seeing Argo City and Kara growing up. And that whole backstory, and then you have some good actors who are involved. If I pronounce his name correctly, the villain is actually not great, but at least the actor Matthias Schoen.
It's a Belgian actor, yeah. Mathias
Yeah, he's a good actor. And then the parents of the title character are played by David. I mean, seen flashbacks are played by David Krumholtz and Emily Beecham. Jason Momoa does good for the few scenes he's in. Same thing with David Cornsweet, as Clark Superman. But yeah, no, I mean, there's definite things in there that elements of good things. But as I said, I just don't think this is something you would do for like sorely in the world building or introducing people to this what you're trying to introduce them to. So it's what it is, I guess. So and as I said before, I don't think this was really an adaptation of what they said it was an adaptation of. So, but that's a whole other thing. So.
Right. Next, another entry to a very, I guess, long-running franchise. Anyway, Evil Dead Burn. Of course, I was familiar with Evil Dead, me Sam Raimi's original run back in the 80s. Evil Dead Burn. I guess an innocuous start from the plot. Apparently, it's starts off with a loss of a husband and a grieving woman who seeks solace in the in-laws' house, it seems. And from the trailers, like from around a dinner table, but for those who know the Evil Dead, supernatural shenanigans soon begin. Running wonder what to expect from this. Who saw Evil Dead Burn? Andrew, I'm guessing you caught this. What did you think? I'm very intrigued about, considering its pedigree and.
Yeah, it's a pretty intense installment because it's a little different feel than previous installments. Without spoiling too much, with this one, it's basically a sequel to Evil Dead Rise, and possibly it ties into other installments because there's another Evil Dead installment that's coming out. I think in a couple of years' time, that's actually a prequel to the first movie. So I think they're trying to tie everything together, like a lot of arc welding. But this one is a sequel to the previous installment, Evil Dead Rise, and I think people were a little confused by that. But it is, without saying too much, because there's stuff that happens early in this film, and you're sort of like, and yeah, that's it's a sequel to. That's stuff you saw in the previous film. So, but you're focusing on new characters, but in this continuity that follows from the again the previous film. So this one is directed by Sebastian Vanacek. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. Is a French filmmaker. He directed a film whose the title in English was Infested. A bunch of spiders infesting a block of flats, apartment complex. So he directed that film and he directs this film. And I think there's a theme in real life that this is more of like a French extremities film has been called rather than like an Evil Dead film. Like these French horror films like Haute Tension or Martyrs, like those films from the 2000s, those types of French horror films, rather than necessarily an Evil Dead film. I mean, it is Evil Dead. You do have the Deadites, and the Deadites do what they do. They torment and ultimately do bad stuff, and people get possessed and become Deadites. But they're less playful this time around. They're not like there's not really the blend of horror comedy that people are used to from the franchise. I mean, there is, but I think the comedy tends to come more from human characters rather than the Deadites themselves are more like, serious and get down to business with this installment. So basically to set up just the plot as what it is. Basically you have this this one person that I guess one of his ancestors collected the Kandarian dagger, which is something introduced in earlier installments that can harm the Deadites. So this person uncovers his ancestors' collections of the Necronomicon and the Kandarian dagger. And when he uncovers the Kandarian dagger, that attracts the Deadites' attention, and then they start coming for this family. And so that's what really kind of kicks off the plot and this family in danger from these Deadites that are coming for them. And so you have a new protagonist named Alice. And so her husband gets killed. And so the death and the funeral is what brings the family together. And so Alice is sort of the one who's kind of trying to deal with all the stuff that's going on. But she's kind of like an outsider because she married into this family. And there's also themes of abuse and, people who were bad when they were, just plain human. And, how does that deal with, what this new protagonist is going to deal with? I think the actress's name is Suella Jacob. And she's from Switzerland in real life, but I guess here her character is French. Again, dealing with the tying in with the French extremities and that whole this meta, what's going on there in real life. So she's Alice is the protagonist, and you know how you're dealing with that, and how she's dealing with the family and their issues, and now these deadites are showing up, and how she's dealing with that, and it's definitely a different feel, like I said, from previous installments. It's a lot more serious, a lot more of the deadites getting down to business, and a lot more really gruesome stuff. I generally liked it. It's definitely different. I don't I wasn't bothered by it as much. I know some people, they kind of wanted more of the blend of comedy and horror from the previous installments. The only thing I really kind of issue with was the post credits scene. There's like a mid credits and a post credit scene or scenes, and the post credit, as opposed to the mid credit scene, the post credit scene does something, without going to spoilers, then kind of makes to go, and how does that work going forward? So I kind of wonder if they're planning something going forward with the whole arc welding thing. So we'll see what happens there. I mean, it's definitely, I appreciated what the film was. I know some fans of the previous installments, or what they kind of expect from previous installments. I don't know if they maybe have issues with this film and what it does. So, we'll see. I mean, it's what it is, and it does have Evil Dead in the title. So, people just have the mindset of what it is. So, yeah, but
Okay.
I appreciated it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, horror always does kind of well, so it's it always seems to be a genre that survives. But okay. Right. Next. Another IP makes its way to Prime Video this time. Of course it had a cinema release, but it proved so popular that they rushed it onto streaming as fast as possible. That's my reading of it anyway. Maybe not so much a huge blockbuster, but an interesting attempt at rebooting a very, or interpreting a, I guess rebooting another old franchise, Masters of the Universe. This is, of course, based on the toy line and popular cartoon series back in the 80s. Nicholas Galanti, I think, takes the mantle here of Prince Adam, also known as He-Man, who is left stranded on Earth, but then makes his way back to the wonderful world of Eternia, full of magic dragons, and trying to reclaim the throne from the evil Skeletor. So fans of the toy line who've grown up would be familiar, but those new to it may be a bit perplexed. But is this, I think, Richard, again, you're first in line, I'm sure, to switch on to Prime, as I did, as out of sheer morbid curiosity. He-Man, did you feel the power of Grayskull in
Yeah.
He-Man, Richard?
How do you say it in English? By the power of
By
what?
the power of Grayskull,
Okay. Par le pouvoir du crâne ancestral in French. So, okay, fine enough. Close enough. Okay. By the way, He-Man in French is called Musclor, if you know the anecdotes. So, like muscle, and you put OR at the end, Musclor. That's very original. Anyway. So yeah, that's interesting. Well, not the movie. The movie is not that interesting. Is there
No.
anything around the movie that is interesting? I mean, this kind of movie that should have been, this movie should have been released in Amazon Prime straight away. I have no idea what they thought. What crossed my mind is say, yeah, we have something that's gonna be a huge success in movie theaters. I don't see it, to be honest. It's a movie made for Amazon Prime. I mean, there are so many movies in Amazon and Netflix every single week. This is kind of them. What is one of them, sorry. And it's okay. As a streaming movie, actually, I think it's an okay movie. But I have no idea who thought, yeah, let's do a big release in the movie theater. No idea. Why I say that is because, well, What is the target audience of this movie? For this
Indeed, good
movie?
question. I didn't know
I'm
who this was
guessing
aimed
people
for.
in their 40s and 50s, but do you really think that people in their 40s and 50s, there's like a huge fan base around the world for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, so much so that actually they would spend $15 to go to see the movie theater? I don't think so. I mean, it's not Star Wars, it's not Marvel, it's not, I mean, it's just a cartoon of the 80s. That's all it is in the end. And not every single IP from the 80s should get a movie theater release, and that's proof of it. But that being said, the movie itself, as I said, it's okay. On a late night, it's all right. It's just the main problem is that I think it should have go went all the way in. What I mean is that it should have been every single thing that you get from the cartoon of the 80s should have been adapted. And not trying to be something that it is not. It's trying to be, for most of the movie, it's trying to be a Thor Ragnarok ripoff, in my opinion. Again, I really had that feeling from like 10, 15 minutes. I felt actually I was watching Thor having another adventure. It has kind of the same funny, trying to be funny vibe, the funny dialogues with a character that kind of doesn't care what's going on around him. But he's not Chris Hemsworth. I'm saying physically, I'm talking about the funny vibe of Chris Hemsworth. He's very funny, Chris Hemsworth, in these latest installments. The whole story of him stranded on Earth, trying to go back on Asgard slash Eternia. So it is the same story of Thor in the end, kind of, when you think about it. That being said, as I said, it's the anti. No, sorry, I was about to say a stupid thing. I was about to say it's the anti Jeremy Irons Dungeons and Dragon. But actually,
Yes.
no, actually, sorry, I forgot there was a good Dungeons and Dragon. But so actually, it's kind of similar to Dungeons and Dragon a few years ago. But Dungeons and Dragon a few years ago was better, to be fair. But it is the same vibe. It is the same kind of stuff. It's a decent movie. As I said, you won't watch it 10 times, but it's okay. I mean, it's all right. Nothing more to talk about. But you don't spend the 200 million on this movie. They did 150 or something. They could have spent like 50 million less, and it'd still be a good investment, I think.
So yeah, it is again another big IP. And when we're talking about Supergirl, which is struggling with its identity, or even, I agree, it should have even leaned into it, or but instead it wants to almost half apologize, half joke what it is, because it doesn't really have any confidence to be what it is. Some things should not don't really work as a reinvented as an IP as this one. Of course, this was previous incarnation, which what had better timing was the Master of the Universe with Dolph Lundgren, who makes a cameo in this, but even then, that didn't really work because trying strangely the same premise, stranded on Earth and making its way back. It's just strange. Either lean in, go hard, and then like the cartoon. I think the actually cartoon is works always works somehow because of the performances and a bit of camp in it, obviously. But yeah, I just did not know what. Seem to waste the money, and it's a shame. You want it to work, yeah? It has a enough sincerity in it, but it just doesn't seem to know what it exists for, really. But Andrew, did you manage to catch
Yeah.
He-Man? Did it?
Seeing the film, I thought the film was all right for what it was, and I feel like if the film had come out, and you've already gone over this, but it was something that had come out like 15 or 10 years ago, which is I think what the original plans were. The project was first announced back in 2009, so this is something that's been kind of kicking around for as long as it's been kicking around. So had it come out closer to when it was first announced, then that might have gained a better reaction. It's just, 80s nostalgia and 80s toy nostalgia was more of a thing when they first announced this project. You had the Transformers movies, you had the G.I. Joe movies, and then you had this, being announced around that time period. So people who were of that generation and who would have wanted to see this film would have, would have had a better reaction then. And instead, coming out in 2026 now, it's just like, oh, okay, nostalgia around an 80s toy line or 80s cartoon just doesn't have the same feels. A lot of those people have aged out, and people who do go to the movies now, they just it doesn't really resonate. I mean, it's like now it's about 2000s nostalgia or maybe late 90s nostalgia, not 80s nostalgia. And then the other thing, and you mentioned a little bit with the Thor analogy or Thor reference, but I feel like just in general, it was like a lot of stuff you just see in the MCU, not just with Thor, but also with Guardians of the Galaxy and the other characters, this sort of blend of comedy and snarkiness, as well as the whole action and being in a strange scenario kind of thing, fish out of water, that kind of thing. It's already been kind of done with the MCU and the other characters, and to see it in this environment, it's like it doesn't feel as fresh. It's just like I've already seen this before. It just doesn't feel as new. Maybe had it come out when it was supposed to come out, then it would have been like, oh, this is something new. This is a lot more fun. As I said, it's fine for what it is, and I feel if people who grew up with the cartoon series and grew up with that and seeing this, they saw it in the 1987 film and it was kind of eh. And now the technology is advanced where, characters who you couldn't really do in that film in the 80s, now you can do them properly because technology has advanced where you could do that without giving too much spoilers. And a lot of the fan moments and fan service moments, like, oh, he did the thing or he said the line and getting all excited. And once again, you have like a mid credits and a post credits scenes. So I think they said they're going to try to do a sequel. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. And I do appreciate Amazon at least giving this a cinematic run. You can't just have stuff going to streaming. I think initially this was with Netflix for a time before falling to Amazon. So, I know it seems tempting to just say send everything direct to streaming, but doesn't make cinema owners very happy to hear that. So, at least I appreciate them giving cinemas a chance. I just say what I said before, that this is something that probably should have been, and I think they wanted it to come out years ago. With this, it's coming out when it's coming out. The film is directed by, side note, it's directed by Travis Knight, filmmaker, who is also a son of the Nike co-founder Phil Knight. And the cast, I know you make jokes about Jared Leto. I think it's a thing that Jared Leto has to really do villains who are skull-faced, this movie and the Haunted Mansion movie. So maybe that's his thing, is that doing skull-faced villains in franchises. So yeah,
Okay.
no, I
Yeah, he seemed to be enjoying himself in that performance, at least he's off screen, but he's a more lively performance than I've seen him in years. So maybe he has a future in that,
I feel sorry for him because honestly, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, look at all these franchises that have box office bombs
The
because of
opposite of
him.
the
Well, not
mind
because
is
of him,
touch.
not because of him,
Not because of, yeah, yes, I
but
know. I don't know. Maybe he's eventually, statistically, he has to hit a home run one day. Who knows? Right. Next, think a bit more serious fear. This is Dear Girl. I think a two-part. I think I'm guessing a biography of Charles de Gaulle's
kind of.
from, I guess, World War II, from his rise as a military leader to his emergence in French politics. Richard, we'll go to you. Obviously, I'm guessing you've seen it. This has caught your eye. Is it a
Absolutely.
documentary, a biopic? It's
No,
what's
it is a biopic, huh? It's a fiction, but obviously inspired a lot by so it's not the life of Charles de Gaulle, it's just a few years of his life. It is two long movies, 2 hours and a half each, so 5 hours in total. But it only spans over 4 or 5 years, I'd say, 1939, 1940, I'd say, until 1944, and that's it. So literally, it focuses on General de Gaulle, because there are two de Gaulle in the history of France. You have General Charles de Gaulle. The same guy, but two stories. General Charles de Gaulle, who is obviously the guy, one of the main reason why France was liberated, let's say. and during World War II. But then 14 years later, 13 years later, after the end of World War II, he came back to Paris, let's say, and became French president. But that part is not it's not developed in this movie. The movie is focused on the World War II. I think that this is perhaps one of the best movie I've seen this year by far, which is surprising because usually when I go watch a French movie, especially when it's trying to be a huge, big movie with a lot of money spent, etc., I kind of have my doubts, saying, okay, France doesn't do that kind of stuff usually. France is not good at spending money on with great spectacles and big scenes, etc. Or when we do that, usually we fail. It was extraordinary sometimes. It has the exact, to me anyway, the right balance between history, but also the emotional part. Obviously, it's very emotional for any French guy who watch this movie, obviously. But I'm guessing, even if you're not French, talking about the occupation of France by the Nazis for 4 years, even him himself, by himself in London for quite a long time, for a couple of years, actually thinking actually that he's a traitor, that he's been if he sets foot in France, he will be punishable by death, and he still actually is very stubborn, and he keeps believing actually the impossible. And the balance, as I said, in the other part is the scenes of the fights, especially the fights. So it's not a movie like Saving Private Ryan. You have allies fighting Nazis, etc. It's definitely focused only when it's about fights, the fight of the France Libre. And the France Libre is kind of the army created by de Gaulle and his crew in London, of any French soldiers who've been able actually to leave France and run away from France. And to recreate a kind of small army that's gonna help the British army, they're gonna help the American army at some different parts of the world, especially in North Africa. And the scenes, their fights, which are quite amazing, they are really accurate with the facts that we see, the historical facts on screen. And you have so much respect for these guys, because usually the battles are like one against 10 Nazi guys. That's the ratio. You have like 200 guys against 3,000 or 30,000 guys, and they manage actually to survive for 10, 15 days or things like that. It's really well done. There are different storylines of youngsters who actually have to stay in Paris during the whole occupation, and they try to do their part and do what they can to face the Nazi invader. You have the birth of the French Resistance with Jean Moulin, who is another French hero of the World War II. It's quite extraordinary to be able, actually, as I said, to not being full of cliches, not being a very patriotic movie, etc., just delivering a good movie, good pacing with everything that you need for an historical movie, and not losing your audience with too much history, and not forgetting that actually that you also have to develop your characters. All these things that you should get in all movies in the end, but you really get it here. It's really, really a great experience. Obviously, I am a bit biased because I'm French, so that's why I understand that. Obviously it's very important for me because it's my own history, and especially it has obviously a lot of, you think about what's happening right now in French politics. I will not talk about this, but it obviously makes you think. That's why I'm curious. I hope actually it will be released at some point, US, UK, wherever, so you can have a look, even on streaming service, who knows. So you have your own opinion as a foreigner, if you can enjoy it as much as a French guy can enjoy it.
Oh, we'll keep an eye out. Right. Well, that's our little summer soiree. Thank you for Andrew, Alfonso, and Richard for listening. We'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this film and TVReview.com episode. Catch the latest film and TV reviews, together with regular episode content from the world of film and TV every week. See you soon. Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today.